27. Start with our summary statement. Psalm 97 praises the Lord. For his coming brings judgment. And joy to all the earth. Go over that again. Psalm 97 praises the Lord, for his coming brings judgment and joy to all the earth. We'll outline this psalm in two parts. Verses 1 to 7, the darkness of judgment. Verses 8 to 12, the light of deliverance. Go over that one more time. Verses 1 to 7, the darkness of judgment. Verses 8 to 12, the light of deliverance. All right, so we'll move to our observations for this psalm. Psalm 97 has no superscription, as you can see there. It's sort of along the same line of what we looked at in the last psalm. So Psalm 95 is attributed to David by the writer of Hebrews, and it had certain thematic and textual connections to 1 Chronicles chapter 16, particularly verses 23 to 33. When the ark was brought back to Jerusalem and put in the tent that David had placed for it. And Psalm 96 follows that psalm, and it had connections, strong connections with Psalm 95 and with 1 Chronicles 16 as well. And it's the same way with Psalm 97. It has connections to Psalms 95 and 96 and 1 Chronicles chapter 16. So, much like Psalm 96 then, Psalm 97, and it was held according to Jewish tradition to have been written by David. Again, we don't have real firm evidence of that, but it was either written by David or it seems to have been written deliberately in connection with 1 Chronicles chapter 16, and that certainly could be possible. It seems most likely to me that that they were written by David, but just cannot be entirely sure about that beyond Psalm 95. Psalm 97 has no musical direction, and it does have these calls to rejoice, and the rejoicing, the word that's used there, indicates shouting for joy, and it can also be applied to singing, like singing aloud for joy. There's not any specific references, though, beyond that to any sort of singing or musical instruments or anything like that. And so Psalm 97 has no occasion indicated, but again, it's much like with Psalm 96 and Psalm 95. If we take it to be written by David, then the occasion for the psalm would have been the return of the ark, as it was with Psalm 95 and Psalm 96. But otherwise, the time that is written about in the psalm is clearly the future coming of the Lord and not any sort of historic occasion. To categorize this psalm, primarily it is a praise psalm. And so the typical conventions of a praise psalm are some sort of a call to praise with reasons for praise, like we referred to the catalog of the praiseworthy acts and attributes of God. And those can be attributes of his being, attributes of things that he has done, communicable. It could be past acts in history. It could be prospect of future acts, whatever that the case is. Those are typical elements of a praise psalm, and it certainly falls into that category. Has a number of minor elements as well, which will go right along with the previous psalms we've been studying, because again, there's very, very strong connections between these psalms. So you have creation elements. Here you've got references to the earth, you've got the inhabitable land, you've got the islands and the hills and things that are mentioned here. You do have somewhat of a wisdom element as well, because you have the contrasted ends of the righteous and the wicked, as well as what we would consider a wisdom choice, and that is of loving the Lord and hating evil. And we'll talk more about that when we get to those particular verses. It is a kingship psalm. We have reference to the Lord reigning. That's how the psalm opens. We also have reference to his throne that is established in righteousness. It is also a prophetic psalm that would be predictive, future predictive. So the primary prophecy in this psalm is the future day of the Lord and the coming of the Lord to Zion. All right, so Psalm 97, already talked a little bit about connections that it has, but we've noticed how as we've started into book four of the Psalms that started with Psalm number 90, that we've seen a connection of these Psalms, and Psalms 90 through 96, and this Psalm continues with those connections. So we have a kingship Psalm that's declaring Yahweh's supremacy. We've seen that running through these Psalms. It has themes of judgment and justice, as well as righteousness. There's also the use of Exodus and Sinai imagery in this psalm that has been common. Not every single psalm has had that necessarily, but it has been common imagery that's run throughout these psalms. Yahweh reigning and even reference to his throne would also connect it with these psalms. And if we look at the psalm just prior to it, Psalm 96, we might look at Psalms 95 to 97 as a little subgroup. But if we look at Psalm 96 in particular, very strong connections there. The Lord reigns in verse 1 here and in verse 10 in Psalm 96. We see the rejoicing of the earth in verse 1 here, as well as in Psalm 96 in verse 11. We see the Lord's reign results in righteousness and in justice, and that's in verse 2 here, as well as in Psalm 96 and verse 13. We have references to the nations of the world, and we get that in verses 4 to 6 here, as well as Psalm 96, verse 3 and verse 10. The phrase that the supremacy of Yahweh expressed as being above all gods here in verse 9, as well as in Psalm 96 in verses 4 and 5. So you have a number of connections. One of the interesting things, again, if you take Psalm 95 to Psalm 97 as a little subgroup, Psalm 95, as you recall, was addressed to Israel, and Psalm 96 was addressed to the nations. And so Psalm 97 is actually a blending of those. We get the nations and Israel in this particular psalm. So it's sort of like a bringing of those two together. This psalm also has some connections with Psalm 68. Psalm 68 also employs Exodus and Sinai imagery and moves from Sinai to Jerusalem, which also takes place in this psalm as well. Also, the reference to melting like wax, which is not very common in the psalms, but it appears in verse 5 here and in Psalm 68 and verse number 2, used in the same way. This psalm also has connections, like the previous one did, to Isaiah chapter 66 in particular. We have references to the isles and to the nations of the earth seeing the Lord's glory. And we get that in verses 1 and 6 here, and in Isaiah chapter 66, verses 18 to 19. We get reference to the fiery judgment coming from the Lord. That means wrath to his enemies and deliverance to his saints. Verses 3 and 10 here, Isaiah chapter 66, verses 14 to 16. And we also get a particular reference to the Lord's coming in judgment, that is a judgment on those who worship idols. And that's in verse 7 here, and in Isaiah chapter 66, and verse 3 and 17. This is a psalm that we could actually go on with a lot of connections to the prophets like Joel and Zechariah, other places in Isaiah as well, and then move into the New Testament where the same sorts of imagery and the same time frames are being referred to. So we could have quite a few connections beyond that. But so let's talk about the poetic features of Psalm 97. There is some repetition. We get a repetition of righteousness and of judgment a little bit in the psalm, not a whole lot of repetition. There's imagery that's used, the imagery of the Lord's presence in a storm. So that is conveyed with clouds and darkness and fire and lightning. We get the imagery of melting like wax, which would be like a melting like a candle or something like that, the melting of the hills. We don't have a lot of obvious structural elements in this psalm, but there is movement in the psalm. And sometimes when you think about poetic works, there is a sense of movement, of progression. That's also quite common in works of classical music as well, for there to be movement and there to be progression that they talk about in there. So you get a certain mood in the beginning and a certain mood that finishes and that sort of thing. So you do get movement in this psalm poetically. So you go from the darkness of judgment to the light of deliverance. So from the beginning to the end of the psalm, you get that sort of movement. You get a movement from Sinai imagery, and Sinai is not named, but it certainly is Sinai imagery that is used, and a movement from that to Zion by the end of the psalm. You get other smaller movements within the psalm, sort of like the reference to the earth and to the isles. So the earth would be all the inhabitable land. The reference there, Eretz, in the Hebrew. So it's all the habitable land of the globe, of the planet Earth. And then you have the references to the isles, which would make us think of smaller land masses. So larger land masses to smaller land masses, which is a way of poetically expressing totality. We'll talk more about that when we get to that verse. So those are some of the most obvious poetic features of the psalm. So I think we're ready to work our way through. We have 12 verses, so I want to go ahead and read through this. The Lord reigneth, let the earth rejoice, let the multitude of isles be glad thereof. Clouds and darkness are round about him. Righteousness and judgment are the habitation of his throne. A fire goeth before him and burneth up his enemies round about. His lightnings enlightened the world. The earth saw and trembled. The hills melted like wax at the presence of the Lord, at the presence of the Lord of the whole earth. The heavens declare his righteousness, and all the people see his glory. Confounded be all they that serve graven images, that boast themselves of idols. Worship him, all ye gods. Zion heard and was glad, and the daughters of Judah rejoiced because of thy judgments, O Lord. For thou, Lord, art high above all the earth. Thou art exalted far above all gods. Ye that love the Lord hate evil. He that preserveth the souls of his saints, he delivereth them out of the hand of the wicked. Light is sown for the righteous, and gladness for the upright in heart. Rejoice in the Lord, ye righteous, and give thanks at the remembrance of his holiness. So verse number one is the opening declaration and call to praise for this psalm. So the opening declaration is that first phrase there, the Lord reigneth. And we see this not a lot in the psalm, but we've seen it a few times before. We've got specifically that the Lord reigneth over the nations in Psalm 47 and verse number 8. And then in Psalm 93:1 and Psalm 96:10, we have this declaration, the Lord reigneth. And it stands at the head of this psalm as the reason for everything that follows. So the Lord reigneth, that is the declaration, that is the reality state from which everything else in this psalm is going to flow. So you can think of it as stated right at the very beginning, this is the reason for everything else that follows. The Lord reigns. And so, everything else follows in this psalm from that. Now, when you look at the psalm, you realize then there are two primary results of the Lord's reign. And they are, in the order we encounter them in this psalm, judgment and then deliverance. So the Lord reigns, and because of that, there is judgment on the earth and there is deliverance. So all that is involved in both of those, judgment and deliverance, all that is involved in those come about because he reigns in heaven over all his creation. And from that, we know that he extends his reign to the earth in the person of his mediatorial king, who will come as judge to execute the judgments that are spoken of. So that is the opening declaration that just sets all of this psalm up. And then the call to praise comes, let the earth rejoice, let the multitude of the isles be glad, and so on. And you see there that the call to praise, there's a parallel of the earth, which is the inhabitable land of the earth, the land masses of the earth, and the abundant isles, which would give us the idea of smaller. So we might think of large continents and smaller islands and things like that, so that you have, again, you have that movement. So you have this, what this does is that it includes the large land masses to small, or it's another way of expressing all the earth. Now, the isles in particular, or the coastlands, sometimes it might be referred to, it was a common way to refer to non-Israel lands. And the thinking of the isles then was more of a reference to far-off places, and it was a way of sort of poetically expressing to the ends of the earth. And so that's the point of the phrase we have here, that it's going to all ends of the earth, even from the great land masses to the small. They're going to rejoice because the Lord reigns, and they're going to do so because of his coming, as we will see. So the Lord's reign results in the face of the earth being covered with his praise. And then as we move to verses 2 to 4, this is where we get this strong imagery of the Lord's presence. What is the Lord's presence? What does his coming look like? And that's where it's described in verses 2 to 4. So the imagery that is used is the imagery that was used to describe the Lord's presence on Mount Sinai. That you can find that in places like Exodus chapter 19, verses 16 to 20, Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 11, chapter 5, verse 22. It's referred to in Psalm 68, verse 2 and 8. And so this presence of the Lord, this clouds and darkness and fire and lightning, it's an image that evokes terror. It's a terrifying image. It's like the image of a terrible and dreadful, powerful storm. And Israel experienced terror at the Lord's presence on Mount Sinai. The writer of Hebrews refers to that as well in Hebrews chapter number 12. So this cloud and darkness and fire and lightning, again, it is the imagery of the Lord's presence on Mount Sinai. Now the point here, though, is not historical. So you'll notice that the point here is eschatological, or it is future. In other words, he's not calling them to remember and to think on that time, to reminisce about that. That's not the point. The point is that same Lord that appeared on Mount Sinai and was the terror of the people of Israel, that shook the mountain and all of those things that are associated with that same Lord will come again, not to Sinai this time, but to Mount Zion. And of course, we get that by the end of the psalm. So it's the same Lord who came down on Mount Sinai who will come down on Mount Zion. And his presence will be a terror to his enemies. And that is the point of the psalm, because as you proceed, you go into judgment. So the Lord's coming, then, his presence and his throne are established in righteousness and judgment. In other words, these are the absolute character of his reign, and these are the absolute character of his coming to the earth. It will not be possible for the earth to lack righteous judgment when he comes. There will be no escape from it. His fire, it says, proceeds before him. It burns up all of his enemies in his presence. In other words, they cannot stand before his judgment. Now, this is actually the first mention of enemies in book number 4. We've had it very prevalently in many of the previous Psalms that we've looked at. But really, as we move through book four, it's not so much the enemies that are the problem or the cause of the distress or the persecutor as much as we have seen previously. And here so far in book four, we've focused actually a little more on the salvation of the nations. They're the nations turning to praise of the Lord. But those enemies, they will be destroyed. And you notice that his coming is with lightning that enlightens the world. So the result then is, and you can see it there, the earth saw. So his coming is a lightning that will enlighten the world, and all of the earth is going to see it when he comes. And they're going to tremble. Now the word for tremble that is used is a word that does have quite a range of meaning, which is kind of interesting. But the meaning here, and we get this from the context and its uses in other places in that context and description, the word for tremble means to shake or to writhe in pain with giving birth. It refers to birth pangs. That is what this word is referring to. And that, of course, is very common imagery associated with the day of the Lord, which we will talk about a little while later. But that's the meaning here. That's the meaning that we had in Psalm 28, verses 8 and 9. And it's also the meaning that we see in Psalm 96 in verse number 9. I think the word there is translated fear, but it's actually this same word for trembling with birth pains. That's the word. So many of the prophets use this imagery. It also makes its way into the New Testament as well in reference to this particular time and this coming of the Lord. But one of the points we need to take away from that there in verse number 4 is that this is not hidden. This is open. This coming of the Lord that's referred to, the earth will see it. It's like with lightning that lightens the whole sky. If you've ever been in a terrible lightning storm at night, you've probably experienced that when the lightning would strike and flash and everything would be lit up for at least a brief moment, just like it was daytime. And then, of course, the darkness would resume. Well, that's the way that this is being described. Then when we get to verses 5 to 7, we go from the earth seeing his coming now to his glory being revealed to all of the earth. So the word for presence that's used a couple of times here is a word that means face or countenance. So it is the face of the Lord that is being spoken of. So the earth will see the face of the Lord when he comes. And we're told that the hills will melt like wax. And again, that was given in Psalm 68 and verse number 2. It's a poetic description. It's imagery of the great convulsions that come on the earth in that great and terrible day of the Lord. We're told here that the heavens declare his righteousness. Now, in one way of speaking, that sort of puts us back to thinking about Psalm 19 and how that great creation psalm and how all of God's magnificent works are sort of showing forth his glory in a manner of speaking. And that's not the meaning here. So when you look at the heavens declaring his righteousness, notice the parallel or notice the result. All the people see his glory. All right, again, it's not the same reference as Psalm 19. Here it is saying that all the peoples, and that is Amim, we talked about that before, it is plural there, it should be peoples or maybe even better nations in this translation, all of them will see his glory. So the heaven declaring his righteousness is referring to the signs in the heavens that precede his comings, clouds, darkness, lightning, etc. These signs that will herald forth his coming. The heavens will declare his righteousness, the righteousness of his coming. And the result, all of the nations of the earth will see his glory. And that word for glory, it is the word kavod that we have talked about through the Psalms. It's one of those important words like chesed in the Psalms that it's important to at least know it and understand it and see the link going through the Psalms and the use of this word. The word for kavod, it is a word, it literally means to be heavy. So it's like saying his presence is weighty. So if someone enters the room That was a person of high authority and a person of high standing. And they enter the room, then it's known. Their presence, there's a weight of their presence. And that's what this word is talking about. But we've also been tracking how that it is very often associated with kingship. And we've seen it used that way repeatedly throughout the Psalms. And we saw it back in Psalm 96, verses 3, 7, and 8, used in that way as well. And that is the way that it is being used here. They're going to see the glory of the great king. That's what's being spoken of, all the nations of the earth. But notice also, his coming will humble the nations. It talks about those that serve graven images and all the boast themselves of idols, that they'll be confounded. So his coming is going to humble all the nations of the earth. To be confounded means to be put to shame. So all the idols of all the nations of the world are going to be exposed for the worthless things that they are. And that's the word that's used again. They're worthless things. They're things of no count at all. And the coming of Jesus Christ is going to reveal them for what they are. Sure, people trust in them now. They've trusted in them in the past. They believe that they bring them good luck or good blessings, or they protect them from evil spirits and various things like that. And they bow down and worship. They do various things in service to these idols. And they trust in them. They really think that they are helping or protecting. Well, they will be exposed for what they truly are, which is just a worthless nothing at the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ. They will not rise up and deliver those that trust in them when he comes. They will not. Their idols will not save them. Isaiah has quite a large section about that in his prophecy as well. Now the last line of verse number 7, worship him all ye gods, and it is the use of Elohim there. The last line of verse number 7 is actually quoted in Hebrews chapter 1 and verse number 6. And the writer of Hebrews applies this phrase in that passage to Jesus. And when you look at the passage in Hebrews 1, and you see the context, and he quotes from Psalm 8, and he's quoting these other psalms, and you see what he's talking about in that context, the writer of Hebrews is writing there about Jesus being greater than the angels. And because he is greater and made so much higher, he's exalted above the angels, he's worthy of worship, and he's worthy to inherit the earth and reign over it. That's what the writer of Hebrews is talking about in Hebrews chapter number 1. This is one of the phrases from this psalm that he quotes there and applies to the Lord Jesus Christ. When we look at verses 8 to 9, we see then the result of his coming for Israel. So this is the turning point. So we've talked about how in the beginning you've got darkness of judgment, and then you turn to light of deliverance. So the darkness of judgment has particularly applied to the nations of the earth, but it would also include those of Israel that are trusting in idols and false gods and what have you. But now we see the result of his coming for Israel beginning there in verse number 8. Zion heard and was glad, and so on. Now, the Zion and the daughters of Judah are used another time in the psalm, in Psalm 48 and verse number 11. And the daughters of Judah, and that literally is what the word means, daughters of Judah. But the daughters of Judah actually it refers to the cities outside of Jerusalem, still within the inheritance of Judah in Israel. So in other words, it's another one of those movements that give us... That's giving us a totality. We're moving from Zion or Jerusalem to the outer city. In other words, it's going to spread out. It's not like he's just coming to Zion alone and it's only going to affect Zion, but it's going to spread out as well. So Zion is the mount in Jerusalem where God has promised to install his anointed son as king, back in Psalm 2 and verse number 6. And we see here this declaration of God's supremacy above all gods. It's that rare phrase that actually doesn't occur very often. We saw it in Psalm 95 and verse 3, Psalm 96 and verse 4, and back in 1 Chronicles chapter 16 and verse number 25. And that's again one of the things that links all these particular psalms with David and that the bringing back of the ark in 1 Chronicles 16. Verses 10 to 12 give us then the closing praise. Now, love and hate here refer to choice and rejection. In other words, they are actions. They're not just emotions. It's not just feelings that are being spoken of, but it's wisdom to love and choose God and to hate and reject every evil way, like in Proverbs chapter 8, verse number 13. That'd be just one instance of that. And so that's what is being spoken of here. To preserve, when God says he will preserve his saints, to preserve is to guard, is to hedge about. It's to see God as refuge sort of from his part of action. He's actively guarding and keeping. The word for saints is hasadim, which we haven't encountered in a while or haven't talked about much in a while. Sometimes it's translated saints, sometimes godly, sometimes faithful. It's a word that is associated with the word chesed, which we have seen that is often used in relation to covenant loyalty, covenant love, covenant mercy, covenant faithfulness, particularly on the part of God. So the hasid or the hasadim are those that they experience the chesed. That chesed is toward them. God is covenantly loyal and faithful to them. It refers to people in covenant relationship with Yahweh, those who are in him as refuge. So places like Psalm 32 and verse 6, Psalm 50 and verse 5, Psalm 52 and verse number 9. And here we see that the result is that they are protected and they are delivered from their enemies. Their enemies, obviously, that are trying to destroy them, as we know, which will happen in that time of tribulation when all the nations are gathered against Jerusalem before the return of the Lord. They're trying to destroy them, but they are protected and they are delivered. The sowing of light is an unusual image. It's not something used very often, but the use of light as imagery refers to healing, refers to health. It's the idea of joy and gladness and wholeness, maybe a way of capturing the shalom of God, that the wholeness of and completeness of peace. And so there's a contrast here then between the darkness of judgment that destroys the wicked and that the righteous have the light rise on them. So those who fear the Lord are righteous, and they do not fear his wrath. His coming means salvation and restoration for them, and therefore rejoicing. All right, let's go to interpretation. So Psalm 97 obviously teaches the sovereign supremacy of Yahweh. The fact that he reigns means that he is right to judge the earth. His judgment is associated with righteousness and justice in ways it's described here, as well as in other psalms and even in prophecies that speak of his coming and judgment. And he is right to judge the earth. He has the right to judge the earth. He has the right to judge according to his standard of righteousness because he reigns. His judgment is righteous and it's comprehensive. We see references here that keep expressing totality, keep expressing the full extent, the farthest reaches of the earth, all of the nations, all of the world. And we see the justice of the Lord's dealings. The wicked are destroyed and the righteous are delivered. In other words, he is absolutely, perfectly holy and righteous in his judgment. He doesn't destroy the righteous and he does not acquit the wicked. He is completely just. So the messianic hope is seen through the prophecies of the coming of the Lord in the day of the Lord. And this would refer to the coming of the Lord that we would refer to his premillennial coming at the end of the tribulation period that is described in Revelation chapter 19. This day of the Lord when he comes and brings judgment on his enemies, destroying all of his enemies and bringing his righteous ones into his kingdom that he will establish. So we have the use and the imagery and the effects in this psalm that are just a common store for references for the future day of the Lord at the end of that time of tribulation. So we can find some of this imagery all the way back as far as the Pentateuch. We can find it in Deuteronomy. We can find it somewhat in Leviticus. And we find it coming forward in the former and the latter prophets. And we're finding it here in the Psalms. We also find this imagery used in the New Testament, in the Olivet Discourse that Jesus gave, in places like Matthew chapter 24, the judgment of the nations in Matthew chapter 25, and then certainly into the book of Revelation, and particularly this time that is described and captured in Revelation chapter 19 and going into chapter number 20. So just to point out some of these and some references for them, because there are quite a lot. We have references to his coming in fiery judgment at this time. Isaiah chapter 66, verses 14 to 15. The imagery of birth pangs and those birth pangs being applied to the earth as if the earth is just trembling and quaking, writhing in pain like a woman giving birth. Birth pangs shaking the earth. Isaiah chapter 13 and verse 8. Isaiah chapter 26, verses 17 to 18. And chapter 66, verses 7 to 8. Micah 4:10. We could also talk about Joel 2 and 3 and Zechariah. Zechariah in chapter 2 and chapter 13 and chapter 14. We see these imageries used. Cosmic signs that are declaring his coming. Remember, the heavens declaring his righteousness in this psalm. There are cosmic signs declaring his coming. Isaiah chapter 40 and verse number 5. Matthew chapter 24 verses 29 to 31. Revelation chapter 19 verses 11 to 15. We see his coming is coming in righteousness to judge. And so, who is that? Who comes in righteousness to judge the earth? Well, that's made pretty plain in Acts chapter 17 and verse number 31. Paul there in Mars Hill speaks of that God has appointed a day in which he's going to judge the world, and he's going to judge the world in righteousness by that man whom he has raised from the dead. Speaking about Jesus Christ, of course. Revelation chapter 19, verses 11 to 21, obviously depicts that time when he comes in that judgment. But we're told specifically also here that all the nations will see his glory in that day. In other words, it's not a hidden coming. It's not a thing that's going to happen. Remember when Jesus warned them about false prophets that said, oh, lo, Christ is out here in the desert, or lo, he's hidden in the chamber. His coming is not like that. His coming is like that lightning that lights up the sky. And here it says it's going to lighten the world. It's going to be open. It's going to be known. The whole earth is going to see his glory as the coming king. So think about Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 5. And same use kavod here. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together, for the mouth of the Lord hath spoken it. Now these are the words of Jesus in Matthew 24, verses 29 to 31. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, thus shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heaven shall be shaken. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall all see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from the one end of heaven to the other. Now, when it talks about the whole earth seeing his glory, these things that are talked about in this psalm, they've not happened yet. So Peter and James and John, they saw this glory on the Mount of Transfiguration. But that was just a preview, and it was only them that saw it. They saw this glory. But when he comes, the whole earth is going to see him in his glory. He will be revealed as the King of glory. He's not going to come as one who is despised and rejected and barely taken notice. He's not esteemed by Israel or the nations. So when he comes to establish his kingdom, those disciples saw that privately, but when he comes, the whole earth will see his glory. And also, of course, we have the use of the phrase in Psalm 97:7 and Hebrews 1:6 that particularly ascribes it to Jesus. So again, we could actually go through quite a lot of connections with all the imagery that's used here and the imagery that's repeated throughout the prophets and into the New Testament concerning the day of the Lord. Even Paul writes about it, 1st and 2nd Thessalonians. Peter writes about the day of the Lord in his epistles as well and uses some of this same imagery. So let's go to application. Two of these. Number one, well, understanding Psalm 97 helps us understand the futility of trusting in anything other than God when his judgment comes. If we're trusting in our own goodness, we're trusting in our own ability, if we're trusting in our own works, if we're trusting in idols, if we're trusting in false gods, if we're trusting in false religions and false gospels and whatever that it may be, whatever that we're trusting in, anything other than God is completely futile. The mountains melt at his face. Then how are we going to stand? All those worthless and empty idols will be exposed for what they are. So a psalm like this helps us understand that. It is useless to trust in anything else other than the God of heaven and earth. Understanding Psalm 97, this is number two, helps us understand to love God and hate evil. He will judge the earth one day. He will. And if we are not trusting in him and Christ comes, then we will be facing his wrath. If we die before that time and our bodies go to the grave and we die not trusting Christ, then we are going to face his wrath at the great white throne judgment. And one way or another, the Bible tells us every knee is going to bow and every tongue is going to confess. And all of those who do not trust in the Lord Jesus Christ and in his righteousness are going to be cast into a lake of fire. So he's the judge of all the living and the dead. And the only refuge from his wrath is in his Son, Jesus Christ. And a psalm like Psalm 97 helps us understand that as well. All right, that's all I have for Psalm 97. Any questions on anything we've talked about here? Mm-hmm. Right. The word for saint, it is the Hasid or the Hasidim, and it's a word that is associated with Chesed, and so it's a word that is used throughout the Old Testament and throughout the Psalms to refer to the community of those who are in covenant relationship with Yahweh. It's sometimes translated godly, sometimes translated faithful. Sometimes they're referred to as righteous and whatever. But what it says is that those that are in covenant relationship with him, he will protect. So he will, verse 10 says that he preserves, and that word means to guard or to protect or to hedge about. So it's like rather than saying you take refuge in him, it's like saying he refuges you, so to speak. You know, he actively protects and delivers all of those that are in covenant relationship with him, and he delivers him, it says, from all of their enemies.
This may not be a valid question, but do you think that's why the Hasidic Jews call themselves that?
I think that is where the name has come, where it has come from. The idea of I haven't researched that, but I do think that's where that name comes from. There being the Orthodox or, you know, the faithful, so to speak. Yeah, I do think that's where it comes from, but I'd have to look into that to be sure, but I do think so.